Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
High fly ball, right field down the line. Chu into the corner and gone, a home run! Victor Martinez just tucked it inside the foul pole. It was a swing and a miss. Wow, fastball up and in on Lucroy. Gets him for the second time. Fifth strikeout for Fulmer. It was a swing and a fly ball deep down the left field line. Baby. In the corner, got a chance! Gone!
Made up for it.
Ian Kinzer with number 22. B1, fly ball down the left field line. This one's deep in the corner. Gone.
Wow.
J.D. Martinez with number 15. His third hit of the day. And the Tigers have busted this one open. It's 6-0 here in the seventh.
And the way that, you know, Miller was throwing, sometimes the best thing to do is just stay out of the way and let him go do his thing, because that was phenomenal. But we did a lot of good things to get there, you know, down 4-1, and we did some good things. Naquin, and you know, we bunched together some you know, pretty good rally to take the lead.
What we looked at is the Royals of the last couple of years, where the game gets shortened. It puts importance on scoring runs early, coming back and answering runs right when they score, and we saw it as a perfect example today of just getting it to the lead, to the bullpen, and letting them take over, and they did what they do.
You know, I think the guys did a decent job of operating, getting it communicated all across the board, because that's the real key, is the communication. You know, we weren't perfect. You know, I think there's a little progress there. It's not quite where we want it yet. I mean, that was not as fast as we'd like it from time to time. We didn't shift gears often. It was rather methodical today, but we didn't finish drives. You know, that was the thing that wasn't quite the way we'd like it, particularly the first drive.
So we've been practicing all training camp. So, you know, we're able to change pace kind of however we want to. Tonight, wanted to get some work on the road, try not to huddle as much as we could. You know, it was an okay night. A lot of errors that come with preseason number one. Played a good Pittsburgh team and a defense that got after us a little bit early on.
Well, obviously, we got some work to do after watching our performance tonight, and we have some work to do everywhere. Like I just told our team, you know, it's good to get out and get in the game against a different opponent, but it kind of gave us an idea of where we are. We need to get better in a lot of different areas, and I think we understand that.
Yeah, I thought our operation in and out of the huddle, getting to the line of scrimmage, making our calls, and never really had a problem with the game clock at all, so I thought that was great. You come out in the preseason, and you want to make sure all those kinks are worked out. Can't throw an interception. I got to protect the ball. You know, outside of that, I thought the execution was there. There's definitely potential for more big plays out of us, and we know that.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
My, oh my, we are loaded for bear on this Monday afternoon edition of the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Thanks for spending the time with us today. You just heard a lot of stuff in that montage. You heard a little bit from the Tigers' win, Victor's home run, Fulmer's strikeout. You heard some from the Indians' win. By the way, the lead is 5 in the American League, League Central. It may be shrinking as we sit here and speak right now. The Indians are playing, of course, a makeup game today against the Red Sox, and they are trailing. And I think we're in 7th right now, Jim. Last I looked at it, it was 7th.
It is top of the 8th now.
Top of the 8th now, still 3-1.
Both starters still on and still 3-1.
3-1. So the Indians' lead over the Tigers is 5. It could be 4.5 by the time we are done here this afternoon with this program.
Then who knows, Tigers win
that way.
And who knows then, Tigers, if they win today, they start a series at home against Kansas City. They win and this holds. It could be 4 by the end of the day.
There you go. Indeed, it could. So, and then the Indians move on to the other Sox, by the way, which should be a little bit more beneficial, from the Red Sox to the White Sox.
Right.
Starting tomorrow as the Tigers take on the Royals, as Jim just said. You also heard a little bit there from Coach Caldwell and Matthew Stafford on the Lions win over Pittsburgh in preseason NFL action. And then Hugh Jackson and RG3, which brings us to our friend Scott Petrak, who starts out our broadcast today with a little bit of a preseason game number one recap and just kind of an update on where we are heading into preseason game number two toward the end of this week. Scott Petrak is the Browns beat writer out in Cleveland. Scott, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. I think Hugh Jackson kind of said it pretty well there. He said, we realize we have a lot of work to do in pretty much all areas. And, you know, I think everybody and every coach, whether you won your first preseason game or lost, would agree they have a lot of work to do. That's why it's only the first preseason game, because not a lot of work has been able to get done as of yet. That's why it's a long preseason. But, however, having said that, Hugh Jackson certainly has a reason to feel that way, given the fact that the Packers rested so many of their regulars, did not even give them the token series or two or quarter in some positions. A lot of nobodies, a lot of second and third team guys. And the Browns didn't look very efficient on offense or on defense, or really in any way, I think, in game number one. What's your assessment?
Yeah, that sounds about right, Bob. You know, my expectations were pretty low going in. I think part of that's because they're in a new coach, bunch of new players. Part of that's because I've seen a lot of bad football, preseason and regular season, over the last however many years. So obviously they didn't look good. A few bright spots, more ugly spots. But there's a ton of work to do, and at least Hugh Jackson recognizes that.
Yeah, and there's no doubt, and it's really impossible to think anything else, especially, you know, the way they looked. And again, it was only a couple of series, for example, for Robert Griffin and the latest reboot of the Browns offense, the latest reboot of the quarterback position. And, you know, the good and the bad, you know, you get it with Robert Griffin in that first series. You get a great strike, you know, a long pass to Terrell Pryor, and everybody's happy. And then you force one into double coverage to Gary Barnage and, in the end zone, and the scoring drive is kind of thwarted. And from that point on, it was just all, very pedestrian. Your initial reaction after two series now of competitive football from Griffin?
Yeah, you know, obviously that first throw was really nice. He was able to take some hits, which is a good sign because we know the injury history. We know that he didn't play at all in the regular season last year, so it's been a long time since he took a hit, and he took a couple of them and was able to bounce back. You know, you just need to see more growth. I think we've seen enough of Hugh Jackson's offense in camp and the scrimmages and the first preseason game. They're going to take some shots downfield, and that's something that Robert Griffin's been good at since his days at Baylor. So I think Hugh's going to take advantage of that. But then Robert's got to be better on the underneath stuff. He's got to get the ball out of his hands. He's got to be able to go through his progressions, and I'm not sure we saw enough of that Friday night. And then the one interception, you know, you can't have that. I know it's only the preseason, but he misread the coverage, tried to get it into the Barnage. It's a bad decision. I think we'd feel a lot better about his performance if the Browns had capped that drive with a field goal or a touchdown instead of giving it away.
I read one account of the pass to Barnage, and I can't remember who wrote it. It was one of your colleagues, but I read it, and it said something to the effect of Griffin took the blame for the throw to Barnage, which he absolutely should have. It's the right thing to do, even if it isn't all his fault, in which case, in this case, it wasn't. Indicating that Barnage do something wrong, and I hadn't seen any clarification on that. Was it a wrong cut, a wrong read by Barnage as far as turning one way or the other? Like what led to that, or was it all on Robert?
Yeah, you know what? The TV announcers were trying to place the blame on Barnage, saying he should have undercut the safety. Hugh Jackson said that was incorrect, that they just misread the coverage.
Okay.
RG3 took all the blame. I think the significant thing, though, is, you know, Robert took a lot of grief in Washington for pointing the finger and not always taking blame. So it's a good sign, whether or not it was his fault, and I think it was, it's a good sign that he took all the responsibility, because that's what you need your quarterback to do.
That is exactly right. You need your quarterback to do that any time and every time, even if his receiver does mess something up. And he has not been. You're right. He has been not been a guy who's willing to shoulder blame. You know, he takes it very personally. He values his standing with fans and with media, and he doesn't want to be blamed for things. And for him to say whether it was or wasn't Barnage's fault, and I'll take you at your word and at Hugh's word when he said, no, the announcers were wrong, it's Barnage. Or excuse me, it was on Robert. But the fact that he took that, whether it was or it wasn't, is a great sign. Let's talk more about receivers. Josh Gordon comes off of the injury list today, the non-football injury list today. If I read that right, what is he doing in camp? What is he doing in practice? What's the game plan as far as how quickly they will ease him into things?
Yeah, this is his first day back out on the field, Bob. Practice just about getting started. I'm watching a little bit of a walkthrough, and he's got a helmet on, and he's going through some drills. It's good to see him out there, obviously. I don't know if he'll be back this week to play Thursday night. That seems unrealistic just because I don't think they want to force it with a quad injury. But I'd expect him to be back to about full strength next week when they go to practice in Tampa and play the Buccaneers and then play a lot in that final preseason game. He looks good, and I tell you, the important thing is he seems to be in the right frame of mind. Bob, we just talked to him for a while before practice, and he seems like a different guy, and I know that's easy to say in August, but I like what I'm hearing from him. I think he's where he needs to be mentally, and for Josh, that's more than half the battle.
What are you hearing from him, Scott, when you say you're liking what you're hearing? What's he saying right now that gives you the indication that he's in the right frame of mind? A lot of guys are good at kind of, you know, saying the right things, but it's about living it, doing it. And when you've had as many failed opportunities and missed opportunities as Josh, you know you can't always trust that. What makes him sound different right now?
Well, I think, first of all, when he would come back from the other suspensions, Bob, I think maybe he tried to say the right things, but I could at least sense that it wasn't right. He was unhappy. He was, you know, bitter about talking to the media. And he hasn't been that way in the couple times we've talked to him. He's talking about how pleasant the environment is in Berea and how it feels completely different to him than before he left. And I can believe that. I think Hugh Jackson has changed it, and I think Jimmy Haslam has tried to change the environment. And he said he's smiling more, he's happier, and that coincides with when he talked to his teammates who have raved about him off the field and in the meeting rooms, and he's doing going above and beyond. Those are the signs I'm talking about.
We're talking to Scott Petrak, getting a little preseason game number one recap from the Browns' perspective. Browns lost to the Green Bay Packers in the preseason opener. I want to get to Justin Gilbert, too, when you talk about attitudes changing. And you wrote about him today. I read it. And it certainly, again, it's a guy who sounds like he's saying the right things. He's a guy who has been immature. He acknowledges that. He is more mature now. The question has been kind of twofold, though, really, for his first two years in the league. One is he mature? But two, is he good? Can he play? Because he just hasn't been good enough to even see the field in being inactive for several games and getting very little work when he has been active. So does performance go along with the new mental and emotional maturity level? Is he actually playing like he's an NFL player?
Well, he's been better. He has. And he, you know, with Joe Hayden out, now Joe was back with the first team yesterday for the first time since he had ankle surgery in March. So Justin got a lot of reps with the ones, and those were useful for him. I think he's always had the talent to play, and he's not 100%. I mean, he's not perfect by any means right now, but I have seen strides on the field, and I think it's good for him that there's not a whole lot of depth at cornerback, so even if he does struggle, the Browns probably have to play him a decent amount this year. But having said that, I am more skeptical about Justin off the field, even than I am with Josh Gordon. I'm not sure he can keep up the doing the right things off the field and showing up on time and getting to all the meetings, because he didn't do it for 2 years, and he never showed that strong desire to play football, to be a football player, and that's got to be number one. He says he's a different guy this year, but I need to see a longer term out of him.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. He, you know, because he has really, really set himself up. You know, he's got a reputation, I guess, as being a guy that isn't really trustworthy, and you don't really know what to believe. It's got to be more of a show me than tell me with Justin Gilbert. Going back to the game on Friday night, the preseason opener, let's talk a little bit more about just highs and lows. Give me some thumbs up guys where you thought, okay, I saw some things that I really liked from him that I maybe didn't expect to see, and any thumbs down that you may have seen, well, I really was disappointed, even though it's only week one in the preseason.
Yeah, I think thumbs up, you start with a couple rookie defenders. Emmanuel Ogba, who was a second-round pick, Carl Nassib, who was a third-round pick. Both guys hadn't shown me a lot in training camp, but sometimes it's hard to do for the defense, especially the pass rushers.
Yeah,
they both showed up.
The quarterback.
Both of them had sacks. Ogba led the game with six tackles, both active, both showed athleticism. So I was impressed by those two guys specifically. Rashard Higgins, a rookie, caught a touchdown, and I think it was his only target. He caught a touchdown, showed good hands. And then negatively, you know, Cam Irving let up a hit on RG3, the center, and we're going to have our eyes on him the whole time because he's stepping into Alex Mack's shoes. And I thought he played okay after that, but you got to keep an eye on him. And then the running game, I don't know if you can blame the running backs. They didn't have many attempts, but I think from week one to week two of the preseason, we're going to see Hugh Jackson try to establish Crowell and Duke Johnson because he wants to do that once we get to the regular season, and we just haven't seen him run the ball enough so this far.
So that'll be the big change in preseason game number two. You expect them to run the ball a lot more.
I do. I mean, I think we'll see the starters play more for sure. But I think he was talked. He and his offensive assistant Pep Hamilton have talked about how they need to establish a physical running game. And I think they ran the ball three times with the first team yesterday. And I get that. On Friday. And I get that. And RG3 needs to get into a rhythm, but you got to find a balance there, and that takes pressure off RG3. It takes pressure off the offensive line. So I would assume, or I would think it would make sense to me to see them come out and try to run the ball more effectively, kind of like Green Bay did. They ran it like six out of the first seven times.
Yeah, what's interesting for the Browns, though, Scott, is while they certainly do want to see Isaiah Crowell and Duke Johnson and see what they've got and see what kind of a running game they can use to take the pressure off of RG3, they also need to see RG3, and they need him to get as much work as possible. I can also see the need, you know, to not run the ball a ton because they just have so much to not really evaluate. He's the starter, but I guess just more getting him the work with his receivers, you know, get Hawkins on the field, get Coleman on the field, get, I don't know if Gordon will be there, like you said, for Thursday, but get as many of these guys on the field with him as possible so they can build timing, chemistry, he can kind of figure out where they're going to go, you know, where they like the ball, and he can kind of know where they're going to be. And you can't really get that type of feeling and develop that chemistry in practice.
No, Bob, there's no doubt about that. You're 100% right. I think they need to find that balance, and that's the problem. You know, you talk about, oh, it shouldn't take this long to, you know, go from whatever, 3-13, you know, you should be able to turn things around quicker. But the fact is, a team like Green Bay that has an established offensive system, an established coach, an established quarterback, they're not using the preseason to evaluate or to get chemistry or to do any of those things. They know where they are, and the Browns are always behind the eight ball when you change coaches and you change quarterbacks and you change personnel so often. You need to use a preseason for about 19 things, and there's just not enough snaps. You need to keep guys healthy. You need to get chemistry. You need to do this. So I think Hugh Jackson's going to have to find that balance, and maybe that means you play the starters longer than normal because they need the work.
Yeah, and that was my next question because, you know, this is a team that just is in a full rebuild. It's a whole new offense. It's a whole new philosophy. It's a whole lot of new players. And, yeah, I mean, the typical normal preseason routine of just a very minimal amount in game one, a little bit more in game two, dress rehearsal game three, sit game four, just might not be possible for a team like this. They need as many reps as they can possibly get in games that don't count so the coaches can figure out who's where and what works and what doesn't, you know, going into week one, much more than you would for a normal average NFL team that's got a certain amount of veterans that they already understand and they trust and they know what they're getting. And then, of course, all the question marks from newbies to hangers-on, guys trying to, you know, make it one last year.
That's exactly right. Now, the problem with that, the thing that's always in a coach's back of his mind is, if I get Joe Thomas hurt in the fourth preseason game, I'm going to kill myself. I can't go into the season like that. So you got to find that balance, and it's tough, but I think Hugh Jackson needs to err on the side of let's give these guys more reps, at least most of these guys, more reps.
Yeah, and that would certainly make more sense to me. And the risk, of course, is injury. You know, that's the flip side of these. Everybody hates preseason, and there's a good reason why. You know, you mean you have so many opportunities to get injured in games that don't count, but yet you need them because you need the reps, especially when you're a young team like this and a new team with a whole new system being put in place here. But that's the gamble. And Hugh Jackson, you know, if he rolls that dice and says, I'm going to give my guys more reps, more reps, more reps, and then one or two key guys suffer an injury that keeps them out for any length of time whatsoever, then it's going to be like, dude, what are you thinking?
That's the battle all these guys go through, Bob, and I'm not sure there's a right answer. But I'll tell you this, most coaches err to, let's give me my whole team for week one and I'll take my chances.
Where are we with Coleman and Hawkins? Will they be on the field on Thursday?
Hawkins will not be. We talked to him today, and he said he's getting closer, but he's focused on the regular season. I don't think there's any urgency to get him back. Coleman, I'm watching right now, and he's got a helmet, and he's going through stretching. So I think there's a better chance for him to play Thursday night than even Gordon.
And what about Joe Hayden? You said he was back on the field with the first team, and that's fine, but is he going to be ready to go, or is this going to be another week of just kind of testing him and easing him back in?
Yeah, he does not want to play him Thursday. He wants to be real careful with Joe, so I think you'll see Hayden play that third week or maybe even that fourth week. He wants to give him one game, some reps in one of the preseason games before week one, but it's not going to be Thursday.
And we've asked you quite a bit in the couple of times we've talked this preseason or since camp started, Scott, about Terrell Pryor, the former Buckeye and the former quarterback. And, you know, we're getting all these great reviews about how well he looks how good he looks in practice. Now that you've seen him for a game and obviously had a big moment there, what can you tell us about the development of Pryor?
Yeah, Bob, it's amazing. It really is. And we've talked about it. Like you said, I didn't think he had a chance last year. And now he looks like he's going to be a guy that's going to contribute on a weekly basis. I'm still not convinced he's a number one or two receiver in this league. But I think he's a guy that you can line up as your third or fourth guy. You can do so many things with him. And I think he's proven that he can get down the field as a deep threat. And that's something Hugh wants in this offense and you need in this league. And I think he can be of use in the red zone. He would have had a touchdown Friday night, as Josh McCown hadn't thrown a ball slightly out of bounds on like a fade route. So I think I've been so impressed with him, and assuming he stays healthy, you know, he's fighting through some dead legs and he's got a sore hand. But if he stays healthy, I really think he's going to have an impact this year. And I wouldn't have said that 6 months ago, let alone a year ago.
And he got banged up a little bit, did he not, Scott? How is he health-wise?
Yeah, he banged up his hand, and he left practice a little early yesterday. But we talked to him, and he said he's fine. He's going to work through it. The doctors x-rayed it, tested it, and he should be okay. You know, Hugh Jackson isn't putting up with any guff. He says these guys need to be out there. Everybody's sore at this time of year.
Is Pryor going to primarily be used on the outside as that third or fourth guy going down there? And like you said, red zone, we're going to lob it up and go up, have him go up and get it. He's 6'4", and he's got tremendous athleticism. Is he going to be more on the outside? And I ask that reason only because as a former quarterback, we know how it is. Although he was a running quarterback, so he's taken a share of hits on tackles when he's run with the football, you know, in college. But as a quarterback, you're not used to taking a lot of shots. You certainly don't have to take them in practice. Is he a guy that's going to be able to catch it in traffic if that's what Hugh Jackson wants him to do? Or is this just strictly an outside, go up and get it kind of a thing?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, Bob. We don't know that. I think he's going to spend most of his time on the outside just because that's where he's been lining up. But we haven't seen him take a whole lot of hits over the middle, and that's one of the things you're going to have to use the preseason to tell. You know, I think the Browns see him as, okay, if you start the regular season right now, it's Corey Coleman, Terrell Pryor, and probably Andrew Hawkins as your three top guys. And then when Josh Gordon comes back week five, assuming everything goes according to plan, then you add him to the mix, and maybe that takes some of Pryor's reps away. But it's a good problem to have, and I'll tell you what, I feel a whole lot differently about this receiving core than I did before the draft and before Gordon's reinstatement, obviously. It looks like they have some guys who can play out there, and it didn't look that way in March.
Yeah, I agree, by the way. I really have been hard on the receiving core. Well, really, quite frankly, for the last couple, 3 years or more, it's just been one of the worst receiving cores in the league, with the exception of the year that Gordon broke out in 13. They just haven't had it. But they do, given the numbers that they brought in and the potential. We have to translate or transition potential into production, obviously, for a guy like Coleman and Hawkins. Sure. Hawkins needs, you know, more reps and opportunities. It could very well be a strength of this team rather than the huge detriment that it has been in previous seasons. Scott, before you go, though, about Gordon and getting reps and taking away reps from Pryor and so on and so forth when he gets back in week five, what about in preseason games number 3 and 4? You mentioned that they'd probably play him a ton. Again, it doesn't all kind of, you know, work out in a traditional preseason model for this team because of the way they are. They need Josh Gordon to get reps because he didn't play football last year, but they also need, since he's not going to play weeks 1 through 4, the guys who are going to play to get as many reps and pass opportunities as possible in games 3 and 4.
No, and that's another thing that, you know, Hugh has on his plate. He's got to find that balance. To me, you have to play Josh Gordon as much as you can so that he's ready when you get back week 5, right? Because this is the only chance you got to play. He's not going to practice those 4 weeks. You got to get as much out of him right now so you think that he can be ready to go week 5 or week 6, whenever you kind of build him back up a little bit. Having said that, I think that means you're playing with all the backups. You don't take away starter reps. You don't hurt the chemistry, RG3 with Coleman and with Pryor and with Barnage and those guys. But once you're done with what you want to accomplish with the starters, then you play Josh every snap you can possibly play.
Scott Petrick is our guest. He covers the Cleveland Browns out there as a beat writer in Cleveland. And, Scott, last thing before you run, who's the greatest Olympian ever, Michael Phelps or Usain Bolt?
I'm going to go Bolt.
Bolt's 3 straight Olympic 100 victories, which no one has ever done, over Phelps' 23 golds also and 28 overall medals, which no one has ever done. Why? What's your reasoning?
I think more people run than swim, so I think the competition to be the best runner in the world, the fastest man in the world, is just steeper. And the way he does it just blows me away every time he runs.
You mean how he's trailing at the 50-meter mark and then suddenly he just kicks in afterburners and starts striding out and laughs at people as he passes them?
That's exactly what I mean.
It is a thing to behold. What an amazing event last night. And what an amazing event and career by Phelps either. That's going to be our big poll question of the day. I figured you could get it started for us. Scott, thanks so much for the update. I appreciate it. Go back to watching those Browns, and we'll talk to you hopefully again after the second preseason game. Sound all right?
Thanks, Bobby. Sounds good.
Great stuff. There you go. It's 3:30. There's Scott Petrak joining us right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket with the Browns post-game reaction and review, if you will. We're going to talk a little bit about the Lions, who looked a little bit better than the Browns did in their first preseason game. That one, of course, against the Steelers. We got that coming up. We got a ton of things to talk about. I mean, really. I mentioned the packed montage that Jim Cushlin put together for us today, and indeed it was. We had baseball, both teams that we covered, the Indians and the Tigers. Where are we now, Jim, as I was talking to Scott? Are we in the ninth?
Is we are finished? Still in the eighth. Our Rajay Davis just hit an RBI double to finally get the one-time Indians farmhand Drew Pomerantz out of the game. So it's 3-2, but there's still two out in the eighth.
So not over yet.
Not
in
over
this
yet.
Makeup game. This makeup from, it was May, I think. It was
No. This was from the very first series of the season.
Oh, was it really?
Remember? It was supposed to be three. Opening day got rained out, played it the next day. Game two got rained out. This is the makeup for that.
Gotcha. Good call. Okay, thanks for the clarification. So they're finally getting this one in, one with the Red Sox before White Sox, a series with the White Sox tomorrow for the Indians. And the Indians have a five-game lead. They're trying to maintain that and hold on to that. Of course, the Tigers start a series with the Royals. So we're going to get into that a little bit. I mentioned Usain Bolt, who made Olympic history yesterday, the only Olympian in history to win the 100. Win the gold in the 100-meter dash, three straight Olympics. And he did it over Justin Gatlin, who became, by the way, only the second man in Olympic history, along with Usain Bolt, to medal in three straight Olympics in the 100-meter dash, which is pretty amazing in its own right. Who is the greatest Summer Olympian of all time? Is it that historic performance by Usain Bolt? Does that make him the guy? Or is it Michael Phelps, who finished an amazing career and swore after his final gold that he's done? That's it. He said, you might see Ryan Lochte back here again in 4 years. He said, not me. It is the last time you will ever see me in the water swimming competitively. So Michael Phelps caps his career with 23 gold medals, 28 medals overall. Who is the greatest Olympian of all time in the Summer Olympics? Is it Phelps, or is it the incomparable speed possessed by Usain Bolt? I want to talk about that. So we got that on the table. A-Rod, out of baseball, but not for long. Going to Miami, going to replace Giancarlo Stanton. Well, not that he could, but at least his roster spot. It is possible. Hope Solo, embarrassing Team USA once again. We can talk a little bit about that. Like I said, we are loaded for bear. Cam Newton is back in the middle of controversy again, but not for anything he did wrong, for something he said that I think is absolutely right. And he's being just destroyed by the social justice warriors out there who don't want to hear it. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. So we've got a ton of information to get through today, and your opinions as well, at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. Get in line now. We'll get you up and on the radio right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Pro 106.5. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on. You know what? Let that music play a little bit longer here, Jim, while I finish something up, and I'll tell you why as soon as I'm done with it. Let that music crank for a second. Unless it's just a short time. You suck. I want to finish typing on our Facebook page. Or start it over again. Because I want to finish this. And I'll tell you why in a second.
There we go.
Yeah, and you can also talk if you want.
Hey, while that's going on, they bring in Zach McAllister, by the way, in the ninth, and he promptly gives up a single and a double. So no, second and third, nobody out in a game that suddenly is a lot closer at 3-2. Just a weird time. But by the way, I was reading something earlier as you're trying to figure this out, Bob.
No, I'm good.
The Red Sox are kind of mad at the Tigers. What? Huh? Well, they have a funky stretch this week that starts with this random Monday afternoon game. It's the only baseball
Tigers
game.
Won't be good sports about it.
That's right, because they got a getaway game or a night game, I think, the day before, and then they have to come to Detroit for the four-game series that starts on Thursday, and the Tigers have said, yeah, no, we're not changing the 1:10 Thursday afternoon game time, despite that being the opener of the series. The Red Sox thought that they might be able to get some niceties from the Tigers, you know, with their general manager being the former Tigers GM, of course. But no, the Tigers are not going to be good sports about it. So a funky week, if you're a Red Sox fan, a funky week schedule. You got a Monday afternoon game, a makeup from April, from that very first week of the season when there was rain and cold and all that nonsense. And then Thursday, they'll have to play in the afternoon, despite that being an opener and their request to have it moved to the evening.
Yeah, that's it is you know, an interesting situation. If I'm the Tigers, why would I give them any competitive advantage
exactly.
at all?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, my job is to beat you. If you're more tired from your night before, that's good for me. I'm in a pennant race. I'm in a division race. I want to win and either win the division or win a wild card. Why should I give you an advantage? That's part A. Part B, I wonder how much of it Dombrowski's relationship with the Tigers comes into play, if at all. If at all. Here's part of the report from Boston Herald writer Michael Silverman, and this was actually quoted in the Free Press. Silverman says, the Tigers have some prior history of Thursday afternoon starts. Another part of the history is the Red Sox president, Dave Dombrowski, was relieved of his duties as Detroit GM last summer. Is this some kind of a less-than-fond farewell card from the Tigers? Al Avila, bumped up to GM after serving as Dombrowski's assistant, said yesterday he doesn't set game times. A request to speak with another Tigers executive yesterday was unanswered. Maybe this has nothing to do with Dombrowski. Still, it feels like a Bush League move, writes Michael Silverman in Boston. And if you think the Tigers jimmied the schedule to gain an edge, you can read the mind of Dombrowski. They traditionally have played Thursday afternoons during the season, although they don't always play then, because if the roles were reversed, I'm sure they would have played a night game, Dombrowski said. And I'm sure they did it in some ways because they realized we would come in as a tired club, that they did it from a competitive perspective. Unfortunately, we didn't have any right to get it changed. So that's how they feel about it in Boston and how Dave Dombrowski kind of feels about it. And you know what? If it is competitive gamesmanship on the part of the Tigers, how can anybody possibly condemn them for that? I mean, I jokingly said they're not being good sports about it. They're not letting the Red Sox have a level playing field. The Tigers will be rested. Shouldn't the Red Sox be allowed to be rested too? You know what? When somebody plays a late inning game the night before, you know, a getaway game, if they've got extra innings and somebody is, I guess that's kind of the same because it's the same two teams. But my point being, you know, if one team handles being tired better, no matter what the case is, too bad. If my job is to beat you, especially when we're talking about a pennant race and they are still in this race, the Tigers are five games back, maybe four and a half by the time the Indians game ends. And let me know when that happens, Jim.
You got it.
As they trail the Red Sox right now, ironically. So maybe that's the case. But all I do know is that it is their job to win. And if the other team being tired helps, it makes it easier for the Tigers to win, then the Tigers are doing their job. Al Avila, Brad Ausmus, the owner, it doesn't matter. Their job is to try to win no matter what it takes. And if they're doing it within the boundaries of the rules, how can anybody possibly criticize or condemn that, Jim?
And throw one more angle at this because, I have to monitor some of these things to put our schedules together here for the ticket and for Tigers who are, of course, on our sister station, Talk Radio 1470. I can tell you straight up, this has been labeled as a 1:10 afternoon game since, January?
Yep.
When the schedules came out? If you're the Red Sox and you're only now calling to Detroit to ask them to move that, where was that phone call 3 months ago?
Yeah, that's a very
good point.
Both
sides have known that this game is scheduled at this time. This wasn't they changed it to an afternoon game a week ago. No. This has been an afternoon game since day one. The main oddity here is usually when teams do that, not just the Tigers, but a lot of teams, of course, you know, Bob, have been doing that in recent years. That's for getaway travel purposes. This is
right.
The opener of a series, which does make it kind of funky. But it's been labeled as an afternoon game since, like, January when the game times came out. I know, because I had to organize all that. It hasn't changed since. So if you're Boston, why did you make this call 3 months ago?
That's a very, very fair point. And then, by the way, from the Tiger standpoint, too, there's another reason, too. As pointed out in the Free Press, they might want to avoid a Thursday night game because across the street at Ford Field, the Lions are playing.
And that's another reason why it was probably scheduled that. Well, actually, no, those schedules would have come out before NFL preseason. But now it just makes even more sense because that whole area is going to be very, very crowded. Even though it's preseason, it won't be a normal regular season. So there'll still be plenty of people roaming that exact area.
Yeah, that is exactly right. So at any rate, it's a non-issue. It's a non-issue from the Tigers' standpoint. They have all the rights in the world and the reasons in the world to say, no, we'll just play the game as scheduled because that's the way it's scheduled. You know what? Everybody has to deal with little
right.
circumstances throughout the year where you have a late game and then you got to travel and
heck,
play
you
game
want to
when you're tired.
Exactly.
And you played a 19-inning affair and now you're going to another time zone and the game's going to be earlier and you know what? You got to adjust. That's just the way
exactly.
that it is.
Exactly. I'll throw one real quick extra circumstance as evidence of what you're talking about. Take the Indians right now. With this makeup game today, this negated one of the three final off days the Indians have in the entire season. They don't have another off day till Thursday, September 1st.
Wow.
And then I think Monday the 15th is the only other off day. The Indians have, thanks to this rainout makeup today, have now just two off days remaining on the entire season, and the first one doesn't come till we switch to September in a few weeks.
Crazy.
That's
crazy. Now that's what we call serious attrition. You know,
yep.
that's trying to win, not win by attrition, but not lose by attrition. You are going to have guys get tired. You're going to have to rest guys. You're going to have to give guys the days off that you don't want to give a day off, including your studs and your
yep.
stars, because you don't have those built-in days off, and you're in a pennant race where every game matters. And I'll tell you what, that's a real tough thing to be in, and nobody's going to feel sorry for the Indians. So guess what? Nobody should feel sorry for the Red Sox or anybody else who have a little bit of a difficult circumstance. That's called adversity. And when you want to win, you know what? You got to overcome adversity.
Darn right.
That is something that every athlete forever has learned. All right. Let me get back to this, because I said, hey, Jim, talk for a minute while I finish typing. Onto our Facebook page. The reason it took a moment or two is because I was looking for a picture of Usain Bolt and Michael Phelps side by side. The reason why is obvious. I just asked Jim Cushman, Scott Petrak this question at the end of our conversation, and Usain Bolt is unquestionably the fastest man to ever walk on the surface of the earth, at least that we have actually put a stopwatch to. Who knows? Maybe there is somebody living in a remote part of this world where they don't have stopwatches and they don't have, the opportunity to measure him against other people, but who just runs like a cheetah, for crying out loud. I don't know. But of all of the people in the world who have ever had a stopwatch put on them, Usain Bolt is the fastest man in the history of the world. In the course of becoming that, he has won the 100-meter dash, which is symbolically the measure of the fastest man ever. And by the way, I wonder if that's fair. And I'm getting off into the weeds here, and I don't mean to. But who's to say that the 100? I remember back when, oh, crud, I'm going to have to think about who it was now. Who was the Canadian champion, the sprinting champion, back in the early 90s? And Michael Johnson was the American who was the 200 champion. Didn't Michael Johnson race? Who was it? Who was the Canadian? Michael, they raced at 150. Remember, there was this big, because the question was, who's the fastest man on the planet? Whoever is faster at 100 yards or whoever is faster at 200 yards, right? And so there was a race, if I recall correctly, between Michael Johnson and I want to say it was like somebody like, was it Donovan Bailey,
it
maybe?
Was. I just looked it up, and that's the first name that came up, and I'm reading it, and I'm glancing over right now. That looks right. Donovan Bailey.
Donovan Bailey. Was he Canadian?
He was Canadian with some Jamaican in him as well.
Okay. All right. So it was Don. I was just trying to pull this. Was it in the early 90s?
It was the race, I think, in question was 96 or 7.
Oh, so late, mid to late 90s.
So it was
90s.
Mid to okay. late 90s.
I'm just pulling this all out of memory here.
May 1997 at Skydome. Here it is.
It just struck me. I don't know why just now on live radio. It's amazing how these stream of consciousness things can go. But I was about to say, you know, Usain Bolt, fastest man on the planet, because symbolically we have ever said whoever's fastest at 100 meters is the fastest man on the planet. But what if we say, hey, no, don't stop, keep going. You got to go another 100 meters. Well, suddenly he's not that. He's not the fastest man anymore. A guy like Michael Johnson or whoever the 200-meter champion would beat him because that's their specialty event. And then what if the true measure of the fastest man on the planet isn't the fastest for that short distance, but the fastest from point A to point B being 26.2 miles apart, the fastest marathoner in the world? Maybe the fastest man on the planet is a Kenyan who won the marathon. And I don't even know if they've run the marathon in these Olympics yet, but usually it's Kenyans who win these events. They just have a lock on it, kind of like the Jamaicans do on sprinting right now. And it goes through cycles, I suppose. But anywho, who decides which is the true measure of the fastest ever, at 100 or at 150 or at 200 or 26 miles, for God's sake? But be that as it may, we have kind of accepted the 100 is the measure of the fastest man on the planet. And it is in that event that Usain Bolt has done something no other human has done. He has won the 100 in three straight Olympics. And that's just inconceivable. Like I said before, Justin Gatlin, however, is the second human being after Bolt to ever medal in three straight Olympics. Nobody can keep their speed for a period of 12 years like that. I mean, three Olympics are 12 years apart.
Right.
And so doing it is incredible. But Michael Phelps, for what, five straight Olympics? When did he start this? Did we figure this out the other day? His first Olympic swimming was in 2000, I think.
I think it was 2000. I'm triple checking right now.
And then in 2004, he went out there and won, I don't know, a handful of gold medals. In 2008, he won eight gold medals. In 2012 in London, I think he won eight more. And now he went out there and won, what, five in this Olympics? So over the course of...
Yeah, 2000 Olympics at age 15 were Michael Phelps' first.
And he did not win.
He did. That's the only Olympics he didn't win anything.
So think about that. and the only reason I remember that is somebody tweeted something like that earlier. It's like one of those inspirational things. I saw it like on Saturday or something. I don't know. And it said, do you realize that in Michael Phelps' first Olympics, he won nothing? And after his last Olympics, he is the most decorated Olympian in the history of the Olympics. In other words, it's not how you start that matters. It's how you finish.
And
it's just a real inspirational thing.
Speaking of how you finish, one of his last races over the weekend, he won silver in. And just to put Michael Phelps' career in perspective, the only way to beat Michael Phelps is to set new Olympic records.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it was a really cool story, too.
Yeah.
The guy who beat him, Joseph Schooling from, where's Schooling from? You know what? It's weird. He's from Texas. He's from Texas, but he's Singaporean, maybe?
Singaporean, yeah.
Yeah, so he actually swam for Singapore. But he, as a young kid, like as a real young kid,
13,
like a 10 or 11
year
old or something.
I saw the picture right after that race.
Yeah, met Michael Phelps, you know, his idol, and then found himself swimming against his idol in this Olympic Games in the one event that he specializes in.
Yep.
And beat him. Now, even in that defeat, by the way, and I'm getting again off into the weeds, but even in that defeat, that is just another example of how great Michael Phelps is, because this kid, Schooling, young, I think he's like 21 or 22, and Michael Phelps is what, 31?
Yeah, he's 21 because he was 13 8 years ago when the picture was taken.
There you go. So this kid, you know, beat Michael Phelps in an event, his idol. He beat him in one event. Michael Phelps, of course, swims in like five or six events every Olympics and wins gold or silver in all of them, which is exactly my point to asking this question. So Usain Bolt, first ever to win gold in the 100, three straight Olympics. Michael Phelps with more gold medals, 23, and more total medals, 28, than any other human in history. Which of them is the greatest summer Olympian ever? That's the poll question I have up right now on our Twitter feed, which is 106.5. I beg your pardon, Sports Radio 106.5. Our Facebook page is 106.5 The Ticket. And that's what I was typing as we came back into the segment, Jim. I wanted to finish the question.
Yep.
And the question is which of those is the greatest Olympian ever? And I want your reasoning, too. When you answer on the poll question, either on Twitter or on Facebook, offer your reasoning, if you would, and tell us why Bolt is better than Phelps in that, you know, for that honor, or why Phelps is better than Bolt. Or if you do want to go with C off the, you know, off the grid there, or off the board and pick somebody else, you can do that too, but you have to explain it. Who is it? And, somebody said to me on Twitter yesterday when I posted this on my other Twitter feed, somebody said, I'm going to have to go with Jesse Owens here because I award points for degree of difficulty. And winning in Berlin in 1936 in front of Hitler and the Nazis, and showing them that their dream of Aryan supremacy is not even a dream. It's a nightmare, and it's a fantasy because it's not true. That facing off with somebody, all those people who hated him because of how he looked, the degree of difficulty makes Jesse Owens four golds in 1936 the gold standard. And my response to that tweet from somebody was, I have no argument there. But for the purposes of this discussion, we're talking about the greatest Olympian of all time, meaning someone with sustained excellence. In other words, not just for one game,
right,
being the most dominant, even in the face of the adversity that Jesse Owens did, but doing it for, you know, multiple games over the course of a career.
No, good, good call on that one, because the Jesse Owens story is one of the greatest individual single Olympic stories that there's ever been, for all the reasons you just laid out. But I couldn't give it to Jesse Owens in this question, just because, again, you're talking about a full career. You're talking about hopefully guys who were in more than one Olympics. Now, of course, you know, for the record, after 36, the Olympics didn't take place again due to the war until, I think, 48. Right. So there was a 12-year gap, and he was too old,
so
I imagine, by then.
So he
probably
would have
had there been a foot. He probably would have had there been an Olympics in 1940, but there wasn't, so.
So it is what it is. All we can judge it on is what there is. And what we can say is that for Usain Bolt, he has been doing this for at least 12 years now. And for Michael Phelps, he has been doing this, honestly, for 20, since he started in his first Olympics, as we say, in 2000. Well, I'll say, wait a minute, what I'm saying, so that's 16 years. So this is his fourth Olympics, right? 2000, 2004, 08, 12? No, it's his fifth.
This will be his fifth. This is his fifth.
Yeah, okay. So, but they are 16 years apart for his fifth one. There you go.
That's now, I know we're running out of time, but to throw it out to everybody, I've been thinking about this. It's actually since you asked Scott Petrak in our last segment, and he chose Bolt. I'm going to have to disagree with Petrak. Look, yes, he made a good point how in some ways the 100 meter and what Bolt does for the quote unquote fastest man on the earth, there is some symbolism to that and things that go, you know, into the past. And this isn't to knock his career and what he's been able to do.
Hold on. The other thing that Scott pointed out before you refute him, and you can refute him all you want because I don't think I agree with him either. But before you do, he said that the one thing that we can say is that pretty much every human runs. At some point or another, everybody runs from here to there, but not everybody swims. Not everybody has ever gotten into a pool and tried to go really, really fast.
I follow you
in this, and that makes the hey, who's the fastest man on the planet a little bit, you know, I don't know, a little bit more competitive since everybody does it. That was his argument, but go ahead.
No, and that's a good point. That's a good point. I guess all I'm trying to say is, as impressive as all that is, and it is, to me, Michael Phelps' body of work is just mind-blowing. I know it's swimming, and, you know, it's, as you just kind of tried to throw out there, you know, not everybody swims, but everybody runs, technically true. Just his overall body of work and his utter sheer dominance in every single kind of event, whether it's the various different strokes as an individual, being the anchor or on some of these relay teams that he helps win gold for, his whole body of work, to me, is a little more impressive than Usain Bolt's. So I'd go with Phelps.
I think that's fair to say. And you know what else? There have always been, or has always been, a world's fastest man. You know, at one point in time, it was Carl Lewis. At another point in time, and we can go back through all of the sprint champions in history, there have always been a one fastest man. There has never been, ever, a unanimous agreement as to the world's greatest swimmer. There has never been something as unanimous as this. Nobody has ever come close to, well, you know what? There's a short slideshow presentation or a video, if you will, on our Facebook page right now. I didn't post it, but it's it's from SportsCenter. And it's just a quick 28-second or 30-second recap of Michael Phelps' career. Let me spend 30 seconds here, even though it's 4 o'clock, just to read it to you as it plays. Here's Michael Phelps' final resume. First American swimmer to make 5 Olympic teams. That in and of itself is amazing. Third American athlete to win 4 consecutive golds in the same event. 13 individual gold medals, most all time. 28 total medals, most all time. 23 gold medals, most all time. And then they just cap it off with a picture of a goat. G-O-A-T, greatest of all time. No one can put that body of work together. But on the other hand, is that as sexy of a pick as the fastest man of all time? So throw that around or kick that around inside your own head and then let it spew forth from your mouth by dialing 866-240-1065 right after that.
High fly ball, right field down the line. Chew into the corner and gone, a home run! Victor Martinez just tucked it inside the foul pole. There's a swing and a miss. Wow, fastball up and in on Lucroy. Gets him for the second time. Fifth strikeout for Fulmer. There's a swing and a fly ball deep down the left field line. Baby. In the corner. Got a chance. Gone.
Made up for it.
Ian Kinzer with number 22. 3-1. Fly ball down the left field line. This one's deep in the corner. Gone.
Wow.
J.D. Martinez with number 15. His third hit of the day. And the Tigers have busted this one open. It's 6-0 here in the seventh.
And the way that, you know, Miller was throwing, sometimes the best thing to do is just stay out of the way and let him go do his thing, because that was phenomenal. But we did a lot of good things to get there, you know, down 4-1, and you know, we did some good things. Naquin, and you know, we bunched together some you know, pretty good rally to take the lead.
What we looked at is the Royals of the last couple of years, where the game gets shortened. We put importance on scoring runs early, coming back and answering runs right when they score. And we saw it as a perfect example today of just getting it to the lead to the bullpen and letting them take over, and they did what they do.
You know, I think the guys did a decent job of operating, getting it communicated all across the board, because that's the real key, is the communication. You know, we weren't perfect. You know, I think there's a little progress there. It's not quite where we want it yet. I mean, that was not as fast as we'd like it from time to time. We didn't shift gears often. It was rather methodical today, but we didn't finish drives. You know, that was the thing that wasn't quite the way we'd like it, particularly the first drive.
So we've been practicing all training camp. So, you know, we're able to change pace kind of however we want to. Tonight, wanted to get some work on the road, try not to huddle as much as we could. You know, it was an okay night. A lot of errors that come with preseason number one. Played a good Pittsburgh team and a defense that got after us a little bit early on.
Well, obviously, we got some work to do after watching our performance tonight, and we have some work to do everywhere. Like I just told our team, you know, it's good to get out and get in the game against a different opponent, but it kind of gave us an idea of where we are. We need to get better in a lot of different areas, and I think we understand that.
Yeah, I thought our operation in and out of the huddle, getting the line of scrimmage, making our calls, and never really had a problem with the game clock at all, so I thought that was great. You come out in the preseason, and you want to make sure all those kinks are worked out. Can't throw an interception. I got to protect the ball. You know, outside of that, I thought the execution was there. There's definitely potential for more big plays out of us, and we know that.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Hour number two is indeed underway as we continue right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo sports leader. Good conversation with Scott Petrak in the early going of the program. Talk a little bit about that Browns preseason loss. We're going to discuss the Lions preseason win over the Steelers, and looking ahead to preseason games number two for both teams on Thursday. Correct, Jim? Both of them go Thursday, do they not?
Yes, both play on Thursday. We'll have the pregame for the Lions anyway, joining at 6 right after drive time on Thursday night.
All right, we're looking forward to that, no question about that. And we also want to talk a little bit about baseball. They have gone final, Jim Cushman whispered in my ear during the montage.
Yes, indeed.
So the Indians' five-game lead over the Detroit Tigers is now a 4.5-game lead, as they were unable to come back and strike back against Drew Pomeranz enough, anyway, to catch the Red Sox. So they lose 3-2 in the makeup game at Progressive Field today from opening weekend, when the weather, of course, forced the cancellation of that game, or the postponement of that game. So Indians are now at a 4.5-game situation. The Tigers, and what's the pitching matchup for Detroit and Kansas City tonight?
Daniel Norris against Ian Kennedy in that one. 6:45 pregame time over on Talk Radio 1470 as they take on the Royals.
So by the time we take to the airwaves tomorrow at this time, it could be down to 4. And again, nip and tuck continues, or at least could continue. Tigers had lost 4 in a row and now have won a couple in a row. The Indians had won 4 in a row and now, of course, lose this one. So unless somebody gets hot and goes on a run while somebody else gets very, very cold, it's going to be nip and tuck this way through August.
Absolutely.
So it's exactly what we predicted. I feel good about that, except for the fact that I thought it would be nip and tuck between 3 of these teams in the American League Central, not 4, or not just 2, I should
say. Right.
I really thought that the Royals would still be there and be a player in all of this, and they're not. They're 11 back going into tonight against the Tigers. The White Sox, of course, are 12 back. So, you know, I thought it would be nip and tuck between at least 3, maybe 4 teams through the late part of the summer, and instead it's just 2. And you know what? If it's going to be 2, I'm glad it's these 2. Because it's the Indians and it's the Tigers, and we got tons of Tigers fans who listen to us every day. We got a ton of Indians fans who listen to us every day too, and this is what makes it fun. They still have 7 more to battle between one another in the month of September. I cannot wait for those. It looks really, really promising for the Indians, considering they have won 11 out of 12 in head-to-head matchups. But, Jim, I think it's fair to say the Tigers are not the same team. Well, let's rephrase, this is August 15. They're not the same team now. I don't believe that the Indians won 11 in a row against. Will they be that team in September? Do you have the schedule in front of you? When is the next of their, or the first of their seven remaining head-to-head matchups?
Right.
When does that take place?
Let me just triple-check the date. I know the series in Cleveland, which is a three-gamer, comes first, and then in the final week of the season, the Indians are on the road that whole week, and it starts with four in Detroit.
Right.
So here we go. A weekend series, 16, 17, 18 in Cleveland in September, and then Monday the 26th through Thursday the 29th. That's the last week of the whole season, four in Detroit.
All right. So who knows whether, you know, the Tigers will be that team or a different team by the time we get to there. So it's an awful lot of fun. It's exactly what we had hoped that it would be. Like I said, with the exception of only being two teams, I'm just glad it is these two teams. And be honest with you too, Jim, I don't know if my heart could take it. I'm glad it's two. If it was three, you know, it's one thing to check the box score and watch the scoreboard every night, which I think most fans in these two cities, in Cleveland and in Detroit, and of course in the middle of them here in Toledo, that we all do. If we have to check two or three box scores to see, all right, you know, if the Indians win, Tigers lost, great, but what about the Royals? Oh, dang it, Royals won. So it's like I'm half happy and I'm half sad. You know, it's only one team you're dealing with. You want to hope you win, and you want to hope Detroit loses, and that's it. And if you're a Tigers fan, you want to hope you win and hope the Indians lose, and that's it. So the fact that there's not a third major player in this whole thing, probably good for the blood pressure for a lot of us.
No, absolutely. And the Royals thing, to a small degree, does surprise me. I've been saying most of the season when this discussion happens, Bob, that I didn't like the Royals' chances only after the Indians went on their run anyway, because the Royals' starting rotation is kind of garbage. But a lot of other things have been catching up to them this year. I mean, you mentioned 11 game out in the division, not just that. Not just below 500. They're 7.5 out of any kind of playoff spot. So for all practical purposes, they're completely done. And what's interesting, you know, incidentally, for something to stash in the back of your mind, both Indians and Tigers fans, I read something where the Royals, a lot of those young guys, your Hosmers, your Moustakas, some of the guys in the bullpen, a whole bunch of that roster is going to be free agents after next season. So one has to think that Kansas City is going to try one more time before they start losing some of these kids to free agency.
That's a good point.
That's something to stash in the back of your mind for next season. Though it won't affect this year. The Royals are done.
Indeed, they are, and you know what? It couldn't happen to a nicer group of fans.
Real quick on the Nip Tuck thing, because it's still true. I'm still with you on that, but this is how baseball works. Sometimes you have a bad week, and somebody else has a good week. Because a week ago, right, Bob? About a week ago at this time, it was a two-game separation, and I had said
was it two or two and a half?
It was two and a half.
I think two and a half is as close as it got, but maybe it's two. You might be right.
Either way, to have it back up to five, now down to 4.5 after the Indians loss that just happened. That's how it could change sometimes in a week. I'm not going to feel good about it, but I do recall about a week ago this time, I know I was saying for the first time that I'm very legitimately worried from an Indians perspective because it had chipped all the way down to two. Tigers lose four in a row, Indians bash up on the Angels, and it's back out to five. That's how things work in baseball sometimes.
That's exactly right. And you know what? The Tigers had lost four in a row, and then the Indians went out and won four in a row against the Angels in a big sweep. So that's how those things can happen. And, you know, now the Indians lose, and what is that? By the way, another concern for the Indians. You know, we talked about how the reason why they are going to be the team to beat in the American League Central, and you talked about this back when you called the division over almost right before the All-Star break, without actually saying it. You were close to being there. It's because of that pitching rotation. And you know what? Bauer is shaky. He got the win yesterday, but he was very shaky in the win yesterday. And Tomlin, of course, is just getting banged around. Tomlin had one of the best records and one of the best ERAs in the American League for the first two and a half, three months of the season, and he has fallen off, and he took the loss again today. And so this is it's a very interesting time for the Indians. And then
no mistake, Tomlin did not get bombed around as he gave up a couple homers in the sixth, but he pitched an ace. Simple fact of the matter, in this one, the one-time Indians prospect, Drew Pomeranz, was just better today.
Yeah, and I'm not knocking Tomlin's performance today, just looking at his recent results. He's not winning. He was winning consistently in the first half of the season, and he's just not right now. And they got a big lift with that one-hit performance from Clevinger through six or seven, however Tommy went and however many he went a couple of days ago. But it's that pitching staff that's got, you know, a lot of people questioning, are they good enough to do what so many people have said, and that is to hold off the Tigers just on the basis of their rotation. And I don't know what the answer to that question is. All right, I want to shift gears. I want to get back into another story that I started to talk about before and then another on top of that. First of all, Michael Phelps or Usain Bolt? Scott Petrek said Usain Bolt, in part because being the fastest runner ever is something that we can all more relate to more because we all run. We are all on 2 feet for our entire lives, and sometimes we run. We don't all get into the water. It's not a normal place for us. It's not our natural habitat. And so what somebody can do in the water is a very specialized skill, not relatable to all Americans or all people. And I can see that. Scott's got a very valid point there. Having said that, you say, and by the way, I should also point this out. I got a tweet from somebody at our Twitter feed, which is Sports Radio 106.5, and I'm going to pull it up real quick if I can. And it was from Roll Snake. Roll Snake said, "Hey, Bolt is also a two-time champ in the 200," and I kind of forgot about that. And he's right; that is exactly correct. If you win the 100 and the 200, now you kind of take apart that, which is the true measure of the fastest man alive, the 100 or the 200. If you've done them both, you add to your legend and you add to your legacy, and Usain Bolt certainly can claim that. But having said that, we're still talking about winning that event, the 100, three times. We're talking about winning the 200 two times. Michael Phelps has won individual events in his Olympic career, in some cases, four times and five times, on the way to 23 gold medals in five Olympic Games, 28 medals overall, including three silver and two bronze, I think, which I asked kind of, by the way, I'm going to smack Greenberg around when I see him. Not that I'm going to see him anytime soon, but Mike Greenberg today was doing my question, Jim. What does Michael Phelps do with his non-gold medals? Does he give him away his tips at restaurants? Here, have a bronze. I don't need this. Here.
I remember my vote was for drink coasters.
Coasters, yeah. And I don't know what he does with them, but obviously they're just not important, to be quite honest with you. Michael Phelps, silvers and gold, because he was brought up because he won another silver. You know, his second to last event of these Olympics, he tied with two other swimmers to win the silver. And Jim, as you pointed out, and then if you're going to lose in that one, it's good to lose to somebody who set the world record. But anyway, you know, he adds another silver to the collection, and just makes you wonder, what does a guy who's got 23 gold medals do with his silvers or his bronzes? I mean, seriously, does he hide them in shame? You know, I mean, when somebody comes over to the Phelps house and he sees the 23 gold medals on display, all under glass, probably together, maybe apart in 23 different places on his walls, does somebody ever say, "Hey, can I see the silvers?" Or does Michael Phelps just kind of look at him and say, "What are you talking about? I've never won anything but gold. What do you mean? What are you talking about?" Does he just hide him in shame? I don't know. You got me mixed up
well,
with somebody else.
Well, I also
else.
Did the math.
I don't win bronze. I don't deal in bronze or silver. I've got silverware. Here, I'll show you a fork. Well, I've got no bronze. I got no silver. I don't know what you're talking about. You have offended me. Leave my house. I just. What do you do with him if those are what you have? What'd you say, Jim? Jim, go ahead.
No, I was thinking too is based on one of the races that I saw him over the weekend finishing up. I think the count is the non-gold medals. I think he only has five or six. Like, it's like three silvers, and one of them he just won this Olympics, and two bronze. Everything else was gold.
Wow. Yeah, and that's amazing. I mean, it really is. Anyway, that kind of a career, it would take something incredibly special to overtake Usain Bolt as being maybe the greatest summer Olympian of all time or the greatest Olympian of all time, and I think Michael Phelps does that. I mean, does he not? How is it anybody else? How is it anybody other than Michael Phelps when you're talking about the sheer numbers? 23 golds, 13 of them individual, 10 of them as part of relay teams, 28 overall. I mean, it's not possible to comprehend that type of dominance over a period of years. And if you remember, Jim, he wasn't even supposed to be here for this one. He was not even supposed to be here.
That's right.
The 2012 games in London in which he won eight more golds, think about that. God, I apologize. I don't know if you watched, Jim, the would have been Friday night, maybe Turned, I don't know the nights. I mean, they all run together with the Olympics because you know, it's on the air 24/7,
right.
5 o'clock. But it might have been Friday night. I don't think it was Saturday night. But anyway, when he won his second to last gold, and then the next night, or I'm sorry, doggone it, they're all running together, all the events he was in. But the point is, he won a gold medal in one of the events, and then he quickly had to hop out of the pool, and the announcers chronicled it, and they followed him with a camera as far as they could before they had to stop, you know, in the private area. And then he had to hurry up and get in a hot pool, you know, one of the hot tubs, and get his muscles warm again, because he had to be in the pool again in like 10 minutes for the next event. And it's these events are generally, usually, unless you're the exception, like Katie Ledecky, you know, the great female swimmer, you usually only have one or two events that you are exceptional enough to qualify for the Olympics in. And when you qualify in 8 different events or in 6 different events, your break time, your downtime in between them is so short. It's so small. You have to do everything just right by your body in order to get it ready for the next event, in order to get your muscles loose and strong and ready and not able, you know, not going to cramp up on you or whatever could get in the way of you, you know, achieving the greatness that you're destined for. And when I watched that, it took me back to London. And I didn't watch it as closely. I'll admit, I told you, I've never been a huge, or at least I haven't been in recent years. Maybe when I was younger, I was a lot more, but a huge Olympic guy. But it took me to London, and I thought to myself, he's only doing, you know what, 6 events here. And he did it 8 events in London. And he did 8 events before that in, what, Beijing in 08? Was that Beijing in 08?
Yes.
Okay. He did 8 events in each of those and won gold in all of them. And he only had a few minutes in between. He had to get out of the water, warm up, and get back into the water and do a totally different stroke against the best swimmers in the world at that stroke. And then get out of the water and then go to another one. Maybe it's a quarterfinal. Maybe it's a semifinal against the best swimmers in the world at that different swimming stroke. And he did them all. And it doesn't matter whether it's breaststroke or butterfly or backstroke. I almost said backpedal. I'm in football mode. You know, it doesn't matter. The best in the world are there, and he's just moving from one challenge against the best in the world to the other challengers and the best in the world. And most of them don't go into the other races against him. And that, to me, is what sets him apart. All of the different things that he has to do to be the best in the world. For Usain Bolt, as dominant as he is, he never had to change, like, okay, you know, in this one, Usain, you're going to run straight ahead. In the next one, you have to do sideways shuffling. In the next one, you have to do backpedaling. And I'm just thinking of football drills. my players, you know, when they do training and they sprint, shuffle, backpedal, carioca.
Oh, even I remember those.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
In other words, I'm just thinking of different ways to run is what I'm coming up with here. And Usain doesn't have to train for different ways to run. It's just running straight ahead as fast as you can. Michael Phelps and swimmers have to train multiple different ways to swim with 4, 5, 6 different types of strokes spread out over 7 or 8 or 9 or however many different events you're entering in. That, to me, is simply incredible. It's just, it's incomparable. And that's why I'm going to go ahead and give my vote to Michael Phelps. And, oh, by the way, so did the vast majority of those who have voted on Twitter thus far. Right now, and I wrote it this way on our Twitter feed, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Follow us on Twitter at Sports Radio 106.5. I wrote Usain Bolt, you know, 140 characters, you had to abbreviate. Usain Bolt, first to ever win 100 meters in 3 straight Olympics. Michael Phelps, 23 golds, 28 medals overall. Who's the best? And then I put little poll numbers up there, and Michael Phelps has 82% of the votes thus far. Usain Bolt, 9% of the votes. And I put someone else as option number 3. Someone else, whoever it is. And 82-9-9 is where it stands. So you can do with that what you will, and you can disagree or you can agree if you would like, and I would very much like to hear. I want to throw this out there, too, on the Olympics, only because, and I'm dating myself now again, when I say I'm not into the Olympics or I'm not a huge Olympics guy, it's more recent than it is forever. Because back in the 80s, because of the Cold War, you know, and especially in 1980 with the Lake Placid Games and you know, the Miracle on Ice and Do You Believe in Miracles, the whole thing, I was way more into the Olympics then when we had the Russians or then the Soviets to deal with. We knew they cheated. We knew they were the big bear. We knew the East Germans cheated, which, again, were more communists. And I just wanted to beat the crap out of them with all of our clean, young college athletes. It was a lot more personal then. It was great when our college basketball players would get together for a month and never had played before and then are beating the pro teams and all those other Eastern European and Soviet bloc nations. It was great. I was a lot more into it then. And because of that, the 80s are kind of my thing. And, you know, and for everybody has their high school and their college years. That's their thing, too. I mean, I was in high school and college in the 80s. And so I was just about as big of a Carl Lewis fan as anybody could be when it came to the Olympics. I was into it big time. And Carl Lewis was, to me, at least at that point in time, and not just because of the Olympics, not just because of the Olympics, but also because of world championship performances and Pan Am games and Goodwill games and all the different international competitions. Carl Lewis was just a machine. He was a running machine. In his international career, Carl Lewis won 9 gold medals in the Olympics, 8 gold medals in the World Championships, 2 more in the Pan Am Games, and 3 in the Goodwill Games, 22 overall against the very best competition in the world, to go along with 3 silvers and 3 bronze. Now, is that as good as Michael Phelps? No, because Michael Phelps, when we add Olympics to World Championships, has 47. 47 gold medals. So, but when it comes to running, did Carl Lewis run quite as fast as Usain Bolt in his fastest time ever? No. But again, for sustained excellence and dominance, it's hard to look past Carl Lewis. In the 1984 games, he replicated what Jesse Owens did in 1936. And if Jesse Owens is the gold standard, no pun intended with gold, but if he was the gold standard of dominating in Olympic games, particularly in an Olympics where the setting was as hostile as it was in Berlin in 1936, Carl Lewis's ability to replicate that in the 84 games is just staggering. Carl Lewis won the gold in the 100. He won gold in the 200. He won gold in the 4x1, and he won gold in the long jump. Now, why am I bringing all that up? Is it because I'm American and I'm trying to find a reason to say that Usain Bolt isn't the greatest Olympian of all time because he's Jamaican and I like American athletes more because I'm American? Maybe. Maybe my bias is showing here. Maybe I'm being a little bit jingoistic. Maybe it'll be a little bit ethnocentric. But you know what? I think there's something to it. Did Usain Bolt ever compete in the long jump? I don't think so. Usain Bolt just runs. That's it. So when I'm looking for the greatest Olympic athlete of all time, if it's not going to be Michael Phelps, if it's going to be somebody on the track, I don't think it's as simple as just looking at Usain Bolt and saying, there's your guy on the track. Because, again, I kind of believe that you better be doing more than just one event. And even if you do 2 different sprints, you have to do more than just the sprinting events. But that's Usain Bolt's game. He's a sprinter, and that's it. He's an 11-time world champion. He runs the 100, the 200, and the 4x1, which Carl Lewis did too. But Carl Lewis also was the greatest long jumper in the world for over a decade or more, and one of the greatest of all time. So he won the 100 and the 200 and the 4x1 and the long jump, all in 1984. Insane. 4 years later in Seoul, he was back at it again. He did not run the 200 or the 4x1. He could have run the 4x1, did not, but ran the 100 again and the long jump and won gold in both of those again. Then in 1992, he was back at it in the 4x1 and in the long jump in Barcelona, and he won gold in both of those again. And then just for the sake of pure and utter dominance, he won the gold medal again in 1996, he won the gold medal in Atlanta. 12 years after, in the long jump, that is. 12 years after he won it in 1984. Oh, I take it back about Seoul. I'm sorry, I said he didn't race in the 200 in Seoul. I was wrong. He took the silver in 88 in Seoul. So, I'm trying to make a case here for Carl Lewis over Usain Bolt. And while you're looking at sheer, you know, speed in Bolt's case, the fastest 100 of all time, the world record, Carl Lewis had held that. It has been eclipsed, as almost every, you know, it's kind of like the NFL scouting combine, right? The fastest guys in the combine 20 years ago were running 4.4s, and now they're running 4.21s. You know, as time goes on and human athletes evolve and grow bigger and faster and stronger, the times are going to go down. It's kind of like when the 4-minute mile was first conquered. You knew it was only a matter of time before somebody got it down to 3.50 and then down to 3.40, et cetera, et cetera. That's just the way that human evolution happens. But for me, Carl Lewis emulating Jesse Owens in 1984, matching his four gold medals in the 100, 200, 4x1, and long jump, then repeating it with golds in the 100 and the long jump 4 years later, then repeating in golds in the 4x1 and the long jump 4 years after that, and then repeating with a gold 4 years after that in the long jump, to me, I could make a case that Carl Lewis is the greatest individual track athlete or maybe summer athlete. If it isn't going to be Michael Phelps in the pool, if it's going to be somebody who is on his feet, I could make a case that Carl Lewis wins that fight over over Usain Bolt. Kush, am I reaching, or what do you think?
No, not really. I mean, and all that you just laid out in terms of Usain Bolt versus, say, Carl Lewis, just right there. This is part of the reason that my vote for your earlier question that started this off is Michael Phelps. Because it's the whole body of work. And that's not to say Bolt's or Carl Lewis's, for example, aren't impressive. They are. But the accomplishments of Michael Phelps and his events are just mind-boggling. Just the numbers of golds and all that again. And how utterly dominant he was.
And the fact that, again, he did it in something other than just pure foot speed.
Sure.
The leaping ability, trying to reach. Remember, his goal was to get to 30. He wanted to be the first man to ever jump 30 feet. He wanted to break Bob Beamon's world record of 29 feet and, I forget the inches, 29.5, whatever it was. He wanted to get to 30, and he never quite got there, but he kept winning golds, and eventually Mike Powell would be the one to break the record, Bob Beamon's record, and not Carl Lewis. But Carl Lewis was the best long jumper in the world for essentially 12 straight years while also being the world's fastest man. And that is something that Usain Bolt cannot claim.
No, and that's very true. And all these are reasons why, for me, Michael Phelps' overall body of work is a little more impressive than Usain Bolt's, not to take anything away from Bolt's. And I don't even have to then start including my national personal bias in that as well. As you mentioned, Bolt from Jamaica and everything. Now, I don't even need that reason because the overall body of work for Phelps is just so staggering. And then you can have this discussion. And if you're having this discussion right now in this case of versus Carl Lewis, then that right there tells me that, well, as impressive as Bolt is right now, he may not be the grandest Olympian there's ever been.
Yeah.
Is kind of what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, and I think the sexiness of the 100 being the world's fastest man, and that's what we've always called it, and that he did it three straight times, is going to give him that edge in the mind of a lot of people.
Sure.
But if you really break it down and say, well, what else is there to being the greatest athlete ever? Or the greatest Olympian ever, and you add another event in addition to those foot races, and you add, like I said, the long jump, to me, that trumps it. That trumps the sexiness of just being the fastest man alive for three straight Olympics. And neither one of those things trump, by the way, 23 total gold medals, 13 individual, 10 as part of a relay team, 28 medals overall that Michael Phelps has. All right, let me get a timeout. If you agree or disagree, I would love to hear from you at 866-240-1065. On the other side, I want to shift gears, and I want to talk about the NFL, but not in a normal way. Cam Newton is under attack. Cam Newton, the reigning NFL MVP, who drew a lot of scorn and a lot of criticism because of his controversial way he handled losing the Super Bowl. He stormed away from the press conference being all downtrodden and angry as opposed to, you know, other losers. When I see, you know, people who lost, I know that's not an insult when you say someone's a loser. Other losers of the Super Bowl, you know, who answered the questions with dignity and grace, and he didn't handle it well, blah, blah, blah. There were a lot of people who said that the haters, those who were criticizing Cam Newton, we're doing so because he's a black quarterback. In fact, Cam Newton himself kind of intimated that one of the reasons why people might criticize him is because he's a black quarterback. He said he comes along this black quarterback doing things that nobody's been able to do before, and people are scared of it. Those are Cam Newton's words, and I'm paraphrasing them. Well, Cam Newton just did a lengthy expose, if you will, in GQ magazine, wearing some clothes that I can't even begin to describe, by the way, because dude looks like a trip. It's funny. In this GQ piece, and I've read it, and in it, he takes a very, very different turn. He speaks about race in America, and the things that he says about race in America are opening a lot of eyes, and it's got a lot of jaws a-flapping. And guess what? There's a lot of people, there are a lot of African-American athletes who are not happy about it. What is it that Cam Newton said that's got them so upset? I will tell you, and I will look for your reactions to that right after this time out on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Get. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
4:44. That means we've got very little time left. About 16 minutes of outstanding awesomeness left for you. Let's go to the phones. Aaron in Toledo is on the air with us on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Hi, Aaron. How are you?
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Hey, wanted to comment real quickly. I caught the tail end of the discussion regarding, the best Olympian pole of all time here between Phelps and Bolt. And I don't think there's any question it's Phelps. Number one reason is, he's got the 28 medals, 23 gold, probably, more than twice the total of the next Olympic swimmer of all time. And then, you have to consider not only is he the greatest Olympian of all time, he's probably a top five, top ten at worst athlete of all time. Recategorize or redo the top 50 athletes of all time from what 8-10 years ago that they had with Muhammad Ali and Jordan and stuff. You got to put Phelps now in a top tier category with all the record breaking and the gold and medals that he's won. And I don't even think Usain Bolt is the best Olympian in his own category. And I got to go with Carl Lewis. You talked about Carl Lewis because Carl Lewis was a track and field athlete, and that's what it is, track and field. Usain Bolt's only a sprinter, and all he does is the 100, 200. Now, if he were to diversify himself and do a 4x100, do the long jump, do the high jump.
No, he did the 4x1. He did the 4x1. We should get that in there. Yeah, he did.
Okay.
I don't think he has any medals in it, though, but I know he has run it in international. Hold on, let me see if I can pull that up real fast. I had it a moment ago.
But even if he diversified
himself. I wanted to be fair to everybody.
Sure.
And it says here, let's see. His personal best and hold on a second here. His 100 is 9.69. I beat that to 9.58 in 2009. And there's his 200. And I had, let's see. In 11 time, he won consecutive world championships in the 100, 200, and the 4x1 from 2009 to 2015, with the exception of a 100 meter false start in 2011. So I don't see anything about the Olympics. That says world championships.
Right.
He has run the 4x1. In fact, he and his team hold the world record in the 4x1.
Okay.
And he is the reigning world and Olympic champion in those three events. But apparently it's, I don't know, is he not running it in these Olympics? I don't know.
Okay, but he's got how many total? This is his third Olympics. How many total medals does he have? Six, seven, something like that total?
It sounds like it. I'm looking for his total right now, but clearly it falls far short of what Carl Lewis was able to do. And as you point out, and I pointed out in terms of track and field, he is just a track athlete, whereas Lewis did track and field.
Right. So, I mean, I don't think there's any question that Phelps is the best Olympian of all time. And he should be put in the category of top total athlete of all time of all sports. So
yeah, the only trouble you run into here, Aaron, and I don't know how you feel about it. We kick this around every time we talk about greatest athlete ever. Is should an athlete be somebody who just dominates his sport at a highest level or a higher level than others dominate their sport, or should it be somebody when you talk about best athlete ever, somebody who is better at so many things than other people? In other words, like a decathlete has to be almost world-class in sprinting, at throwing the shot and the disc and the long jump and the high jump and the pole vault and all that stuff that goes into it. Because if you have to be able to do more than one thing to be considered truly a great athlete, then you got to look at people like that who are multi-sport star or multi-sport stars like Bo Jackson, able to compete at the top level in two different sports and make Pro Bowls and All-Star games in two different things. That's where you get into the all-time what is an athlete discussion, you know?
Right. But to be, be pessimistic or whatever the word is I'm looking for about begrudge Usain Bolt. He's a heck of an athlete. But what talent is there in sprinting? I mean, you're born fast. I mean, yeah, you train and you get faster and you're faster, but I mean, really, how much is there into running fast? I'm just, you know what I mean? Whereas in sprinting and other stuff, there's a lot more athletic effort into it. You know, I don't know if you probably don't agree with that, but what athleticism
does it take? Well, I mean, I do, but I don't.
Fast.
You make a good point. You know, I mean, there's one thing that every coach, especially in football, has always said and will forever agree with. You can't teach speed, is what they say. You know, if you can run a 4.4, we'll find a spot for you as a kick returner,
right,
a punt returner, you know, a cornerback, or if you can catch a wide receiver. But one thing we can't teach you how to be is fast. And if you live by that belief, then you're right. Then somebody like Usain Bolt, who is just straight up fast, and that's all he can do. Yes, he can train and become faster. And it takes a very special kind of athlete to remain the fastest man in the world for 12 straight years. And he won his first gold 3 Olympics ago, and now this one. So, you know, when you do that for 12 years, you're doing something really, really special. And we have to acknowledge that. But you're right. It's different than a talent at something else. Like, obviously, Phelps having to learn all of the different swimming strokes and dominate the best in the world at each of those different events, to me, is something that takes a lot more than just, hey, I was born really, really fast.
Gotcha. Yep. Agree there, but that's my take. So, thanks,
good,
guys.
Good take, Aaron. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. I'm trying to find exactly what, and Jim, I don't know if you have it or not, but I'm trying to find out exactly how many medals Usain Bolt does have in the Olympics. I'm looking right now at the list of multiple medals over a career, and number one on the list is indeed Michael Phelps with 23 gold. Michael Phelps has more gold than any other athlete, male or female, has total medals in the history of the Olympics. He's got 23 gold, 3 silver, 2 bronze for 28 total. Second place is Larissa Latinina, a Soviet gymnast from 1956 to 64. She won 18 total medals, 9 gold, 5 silver, 4 bronze. Then Nikolai Andrianov, another Soviet gymnast from 72 to 80, 15 total medals. Only 7 of them are gold. And then you get into biathlon, some more gymnastics, some fencing, gymnastics, athletics, et cetera, et cetera. And all of them pale in comparison. How about Ryan Lochte, by the way? Ryan Lochte, 13th most medals all time in the history of the Olympics, and he's completely overshadowed by Michael Phelps. Lochte has 6 golds, 3 silvers, and 3 bronze medals, 12 total medals overall.
Now, I have it up here, at least in terms of the Olympics, not counting your
Olympics.
World championships. Usain Bolt has 7 career medals, 3 from 08, 3 from 2012, and the one from the 100 meter this year. No silvers, no bronze. He's only won gold when he's won them, but in now his third career Olympics.
Slow that down. Give that to me again. These are just Olympics, right?
Just not Olympics. Yeah, not world championships and the rest. Just the Olympics. He has 7 total golds, 3 in Beijing, 3 in London, and the one this year in Rio, and in Beijing and in London, it was the 100, the 200, and the 4x100 relay.
Okay.
7 total golds, no bronze, no silver in Olympic play.
So is he done with this Olympics, or is he in the 4x1? Are they defending their championship there? Do we know?
Honestly, I got to look that up. I'm not sure.
Okay. I would like to find that out, too, because right now, then, in terms of sheer accomplishments, medal haul, you're right, and the caller was right. I mean, he just, you know, it's just not there. Those numbers are just not good enough to be called the greatest Olympian of all time. We're talking about now, in his favor, the fact that he has 7 medals, all of them are gold, means he's never finished second or third. That's pretty amazing. That is really amazing. He's always been the best. He has 6 golds in the 100 in the Olympics. He has, no, I'm sorry, I take that back. 7 Olympic gold medals. Now I'm adding all of them up with world championships and so on and so forth. And he's got 200 and 4x1s, et cetera. In the Olympics, he won, here it is. In the Olympics in 08, he won the 100 and the 200 and the 4x1. Everything that Carl Lewis did except for the long jump, he doesn't jump. In the 2012 London Games, same thing. He repeated 100, 200, and 4x1. And now in Rio, he has the 100, and I don't know if he's doing the other ones or not. So that's what we're trying to find out. So it's an interesting conversation. All right. I teased it, and then I got off into tangents here by talking to other callers, and I'm sorry for that. But I want to share this with you real quick, going back to the Cam Newton story. Maybe tomorrow on the program we'll have a lot more time to talk about this. But Cam Newton, as the NFL season is underway now, at least in the preseason, Cam Newton is the defending NFL MVP, and he is, by all accounts, really, really well-respected for the way he treats kids. He gives balls to kids after touchdowns. He holds camps with them. I mean, he's just really a really, you know, good guy with the youngsters. He's also a tremendous, tremendous talent with the ability to throw and run that you just don't see in the same guy very often. Maybe not ever in terms of just his pure athleticism and ability to win the games with his arm or his feet. But he is also a magnet for controversy for a number of things he has said. In fact, he drew a lot of scorn and enmity when he talked about his race last year, and he talked about being a black quarterback doing the things that he does, and nobody's ever seen that before, and that scares people. Then when he lost the Super Bowl to the Broncos, he had his post-game press conference in which he was just really, really angry and did not want to hear the guys on the other side of the wall celebrating their championship, and he just kept his hood down over his face, and he stormed away and didn't want to answer any more questions. Criticism naturally and correctly and appropriately followed, because that is not what a leader and an MVP does. You just don't do that. You don't see Peyton doing that. You don't see Brady doing that. You don't see Rodgers doing that. You don't see the other great quarterbacks in the league doing that. How can you do that? Criticism followed, but some said that criticism is born out of racism. People just don't like Cam because he's a black quarterback. Seems to be a very common theme in America today. One guy, according to his most recent interview, and it's a big long expose in GQ magazine, who does not think that criticizing him for missing the Super Bowl press conference or anything else that he's been doing is racist, is Cam Newton. Cam Newton was asked, quote, "Do you feel like football fans are racist toward you?" Cam Newton says, "It's not racism. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion. So if it's not that, then what is it, do you think?" And Cam says, "I'll let you be the judge. I don't look at it like that. I look at it like some people have certain beliefs and I have my own belief, and we can agree to disagree on certain things. But this is what makes sports so amazing, that we can start a discussion around a table in the newspaper, in the magazines, that will get people's attention. And that's what sports does." But back in January, right before the Super Bowl, he said, "I'm an African-American quarterback that may scare a lot of people because they haven't seen nothing they can compare me to. I don't want this to be about race because it's not. It's like we're beyond that as a nation. You really think so? Yes. I mean, you bring it to people's attention, but after that, that's it." So Cam Newton's takeaway from this, and I know I have to abbreviate all this because we're coming up against the end of the show and drive time. Cam Newton's takeaway from all this is, if people want to criticize me, it's because they have an opinion and they have a right to do so. It doesn't mean they're racist. America is beyond all of that stuff as a nation. To say that there are a lot of black athletes and not even just black non-athletes who are angry with Cam Newton for daring to say such a thing is an understatement. Social media has exploded all over this, calling Cam Newton all kinds of things, including the new O.J. Simpson. What? Yeah, they're comparing him to O.J. because O.J., like O.J., Cam has become very beloved and adored by white America. Quote, "If Cam Newton doesn't check himself, he's going to be the next OJ. You are still black, bruh." These are tweets to Cam Newton from earlier today. Cam needs to spend more time dressing like a middle-aged mom and trying to get back out there, and less time discussing race. And that's a reference to the GQ article in the way he's dressed. Take some of the fame and money away and see if Cam Newton still thinks we are beyond racism. Cam got the O.J. Simpson. All because you suddenly are loved by white people doesn't mean racism is diminished. And Cam Newton thinks because he dresses like a rich man's wife at the Kentucky Derby, he doesn't have to worry about racism anymore. This is where we are in 2016 America. Cam Newton can't even say no. People are allowed to criticize me without saying they hate black people. Others are saying, yes, they do. If they're criticizing you, they don't like black people. And that, my friends, is part of the problem. We'll talk more about that tomorrow.
By the way, Bob, real quick, right before you leave, you were asking this earlier. You're saying bull.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.